following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Wait, let me get up a minute. 1 second. Yeah, I listen to Nicole Sandler. Is it time for the Nicole Sandler show? I forgot to turn the computer on. Let me just walk over here and I'll boot up my computer because I don't want... Oh, crap, I just... Never mind, it's okay, I got another one. Leave it there, the cat will get it.
Got a little tune here, a little song to sing for you. That Nicole, she does something. She's really there and does things.
Nicole Sandler Show, whatever it is.
That's the point that I get to by Friday, especially a week like this. I'm just so over. I'm like ready to take a vacation, but there I can't go anywhere, so I continue working. but the way that guy sounded, that's how I feel right now. So welcome to a Friday. At least it's a Friday. We got that going for us. But depending where you are, oh boy, it's going to be a brutal weekend. If you are in the Northeast, if you're in Boston, they're talking about a snowstorm, the likes of which Boston has not seen before. Now, I spent a winter in Boston, actually, just north of Boston. I lived in New Hampshire, in Salem, New Hampshire, just over the border. The radio station I worked for was in a town called Haverhill, Massachusetts, which was the next town over from Salem, New Hampshire. So I would drive across the border every day. The only point of me telling you this is that it was damn cold. And we didn't have what did they call it? A bomb cyclone hitting us. A bomb cyclone. Now, it's going to be the entire New England upper northeast coast from New York City up through Maine. They're talking about it forming off the coast of North Carolina. So I would think they already got it because the storm is moving up the coast. All I know is here in South Florida where I live, it's gonna be cold. Sorry, I feel it's all relative, right? It's all relative. So if you live in Florida and you're used to it not really dipping below the 60s, like when it gets into the 60s, people pull out their heaviest winter jackets. Well, look at our 7-day forecast here. So tonight it's gonna get down to, what does it say, 46. Tomorrow night, this forecast is calling for a low of 36. Now, that's just wrong when you're talking Florida. The high tomorrow is only going to be 58. That's cold. That's cold for here. I remember, in fact, we just passed, I think it was the 40th anniversary. Maybe it was the 50th. Oh my God. Just last week, it was the anniversary of the day that it snowed in Miami. And I was in high school. I was a senior in high school at the time, if I remember correctly. And I slept in late that day. And when I woke up, everyone's like, it snowed. Yeah, there was snow on the ground this morning. And it made the newspaper that it was a big, I don't know if it was the 40th or 50th. I'm old, so it could have been any of those. I guess it wouldn't have been the 50th, because then I would have only been 12 years old. So maybe the 40th or the 45th anniversary or something like that. Probably the 45th. That makes the most sense. Anyway, doesn't look like it's going to snow here, but depending where you are, it probably will. But we have a different hazard in South Florida now. When the temperature gets cold, and I'm deadly serious on this, you have to look out for falling iguanas. I'm not kidding. Iguanas are not native to this area. Somebody brought them here and they multiplied and they are, you know, they're a pest. And you see them. Sometimes you see it that looks like big dragons or dinosaurs walking around. I mean, they get big and they can be bright green too. And so they can be intimidating looking. I don't think they're really harmful, but don't quote me on that. I'm not sure. But What happens is, I guess because they're cold-blooded, they can't handle the cold weather. So they go up in the trees, they hang out in the trees, and they sort of go into like a suspended state of animation or something. I'm probably using the wrong vernacular, but they go into like a hibernation mode. And when it gets cold, they shut down and they fall. And when it gets really cold, like it will be tonight and tomorrow night, 36 degrees, there will be falling iguanas everywhere. You know, I used to, before COVID hit, I used to spend my weekends volunteering at the Broward County Animal Shelter. I would help the dogs get adopted. When people would come in looking, I will have, you know, been acquainted with all the dogs. So I'd play matchmaker. And I've had some real successes, let me tell you. There's one family that I'm friendly with them. We follow each other on Facebook. And they post pictures, and the dog's name is Becky. And they have a little girl, Aubrey, who I think is now like 5 or 6 years old. But this dog is such a sweetheart. I fell in love with her. And when I saw the family come in, I'm like, I've got the dog for you. And I introduced them to Becky, and they were looking for something different, but they listened to me, and they couldn't be happier. Anyway, that's not part of the story, but I get carried away sometimes. There's a big empty field where the place where this animal shelter is near the airport. And, you know, there's the airport's there, and there are businesses around, and there's an empty area around too. That's why the animal shelter has land there. And one day I was walking, and for whatever reason, the iguanas were out to play. Everywhere I looked in this field, they were all over the place. So if you're looking for cheap thrills on the weekend, when it gets really cold, like in the early morning hours, tomorrow or Sunday, if you're down here in the Fort Lauderdale area, go out to the Broward County Animal Care and Adoption Center. It's right off of Ravenswood, right by the airport, and park. And I promise you, you will see iguanas falling from the trees. Cheap thrills, you know, and down here in Florida, you know, I think that's where we've got to go. Are iguanas good to eat? Jesse Salisbury asks. I don't know. I really don't know. And I don't want to find out. I just know it's a thing that when it gets cold, you have to watch out for falling iguanas, because they do. They just fall out of the trees. And people who don't know to expect it get really freaked out, I would imagine. And I'm stalling, because I don't want to talk about anything. I don't want to talk about anything that matters, but we should, because, you know, this morning, yeah, I start my day very early, because if I don't wake up myself, Jackson, my dog, gets me up to go out. So, you know, I get the day started. I feed Jackson. I make a cup of coffee, and I come in here in my studio and I start reading everything, because I put together a newscast that runs throughout the day on the Progressive Voices Network called What's News. It's also a podcast. So if you subscribe to my podcast, you also get the What's News podcast as a bonus each morning. And there's no charge, by the way. My show is not behind a paywall, so you can subscribe to the podcast and make sure you never miss a show. And separately, if you can't afford it, I hope you'll support the program, you know, with either occasional or ongoing monthly donations. It's how I survive, and I appreciate your support more than I can adequately express. And you know, I don't like asking for money, right? I hate doing it. It's the worst part of it. But there's my pledge drive pitch for today. I won't be like the free speech TV or the public radio people and go on and on ad nauseum. I'll just tell you that I could use your support. And if you would like a painting in exchange for a donation, I can do that too. A custom pet portrait, a landscape, an ocean scene, you know. I'm open to all that. Anyway, so, they're talking in the chat room about eating the iguanas. Ew. Kim says, I love iguanas. Had one as a pet once. Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't eat one. But then again, we went vegan during the pandemic, so I'm not eating, you know, animals anyway. Okay, so I wake up this morning, come in here to sit down to do the, to write and record and produce What's News. And I had just, when I was in the living room kitchen, it's an open floor plan, I had the TV on to see the morning news, and I just saw about this bridge collapse in Pittsburgh, right? This you heard about this, right? This bridge collapsed in Pittsburgh. I guess I did pull audio from it. But I mean, basically a bridge collapsed in Pittsburgh. Well, guess where Joe Biden went today to speak? Pittsburgh. Yes, Pittsburgh. Joe Biden went to Pittsburgh to talk about infrastructure and how the money is starting to be distributed from the BIF. I still call it the BIF because it never had a decent descriptive name. But the infrastructure bill that passed, yes, starting to be distributed. And Joe Biden, thankfully, finally is going on the road to take credit for the stuff he's gotten done. And God knows we desperately need help with with rebuilding our roads and bridges and everything else in this country, because we have not been doing a good enough job of taking care of those things. So let me share with you. God, I thought I had this shot done better. Give me one second here while I bring everything in. Okay, hold on. So I'm going to play for you a clip of Joe Biden speaking in Pittsburgh. Obviously, everything got delayed because he had to go toward the site of the collapse. The last I heard, 10, 11 people were injured. They're so lucky it wasn't more than that. And I think that's because it happened early this morning, like before 7 a.m. So perhaps, it was before there were too many cars on the road. I also don't think it was like a major thoroughfare, but they have a lot of bridges in that part of the country. And one of them just collapsed. In fact, where is the... I thought I had a photograph of the, you know what, I'll pull up a photo of the collapsed bridge after, but let me share with you a little bit of what Joe Biden had to say today in Pittsburgh.
Across the country, there are 45,000 bridges in 45,000, poor condition.
Wow.
It's just simply unacceptable. That's why your governor and your members of Congress, your mayor, have been saying for years, we have to do something about this. I've talked about it every time I've come to Pittsburgh, and we finally got it done. A bipartisan infrastructure law, including the largest investment in our nation's bridges since Eisenhower put together the interstate highway system. And I might add, this is the first time in the country's history that we dedicated a national program to repair and upgrade bridges. It's about time. The governor can tell you we're giving state and local leaders historic funding to make national projects real. Here in Pennsylvania, that means at least $1.6 billion for bridges alone, $327 million in 2022 alone just to repair bridges. We've got to get it on with it. We got to move. The next time, we don't need headlines saying that someone was killed when the next bridge collapsed. We're also providing billions more for roads and so much more. We saw today when a bridge is in disrepair, it literally can threaten lives. As we heard about the bridge, we were immediately in contact with the mayor. Mr. Mayor, you're doing a hell of a job. And the governor and other officials on the ground. And we're going to rebuild that bridge, along with thousands of other bridges in Pennsylvania and across the country, because it's in our interest, for our own safety's sake, and it generates commerce in a way that we can't do now. That's part of how we're going to build a better America. And that's what I want to talk to you about today.
Okay, so that was the beginning of a rather lengthy speech delivered by the president. But I showed, as he was talking, an image of that collapsed bridge. And you can see where the side of it came down and a few cars scattered on the bottom. I don't think there were any fatalities, which is a miracle, and knocking on wood laminate that it stays that way. But wow. So I come in here after having just seen the story of the collapsed bridge. And I read in the news that Joe Biden is headed to Pittsburgh today to talk about, among other things, infrastructure. Go figure. So he did. Sometimes there's a coincidence. Now, I read somewhere that John Fetterman, who is the lieutenant governor in Pennsylvania, who's running for, I think he's running for the Senate. Don't quote me on that. I believe he's a senatorial candidate. That he and another candidate were pulling the scheduling conflict line to weasel out of being there with Joe Biden because what? Because approval ratings are down? Well, shame on them. And if, you know, and that was, Will Bunch tweeted it out that these two men were doing that and how disappointing it was. And that is disappointing. However, there was, I listened to the speech and at one point, Biden looked at, was talking to John Fetterman. So I'm hoping he showed up. I'm really hoping he showed up, that he was there, that Joe Biden wasn't just calling his name out when he wasn't there. You know, I think after the bridge collapsed in their state, it would be a good thing to show up, right? But this whole notion of, you know, of Joe Biden's polling numbers being so awful, didn't we learn anything from the, the 2020 election or from the 2016 election, sorry, when the polls told us that Hillary Clinton was going to win in a landslide? Every single poll said, you know, and though she did win the popular vote, we know that, but still, there was no indication that El Gordo was going to be able to pull out a victory even in the Electoral College, despite losing the popular vote by more than 3 million votes. Go figure. Well, so keeping that in mind, let me share this. A stunning new poll from Marquette University Law School shows Joe Biden significantly leading both the former guy, you know, the orange monster, and Governor Moore on death sentence in a set of hypothetical matchups. This wide-ranging poll, like others released in recent months, shows Biden underwater with voters. Got that. He's still underwater. A mere 15% of the survey's respondents said they strongly approve of his job performance. Another 31% said they somewhat approve. 21% said they somewhat disapprove, while 32% said they strongly disapprove. So in total, 53% of the respondents said they disapprove of the job the president is doing. But when he was matched up in a head-to-head with the Republican Party's two, you know, top contenders, I guess, in two different matchups, he won both of them by double digits. See, this Marquette poll found that in a matchup against Trump, Biden would receive about 43% of the votes, with Trump garnering 33%. 16% of respondents would find another candidate. 6% said they'd simply stay home. DeSantis actually performed better than Trump, but not by much. Marquette's survey showed that Biden would receive 41% to DeSantis's 33%. Still beating them. In such a race, per the poll, 18% would either avoid either major party candidate, while 8% would stay home. So, bad news for Trump. 67% of respondents said they had a decidedly unfavorable view of him, while 28% viewed him favorably. Somehow, 1% of respondents didn't know enough about Trump to form an opinion. That's the funniest thing I've heard all day. And then they say this. They say the good news for DeSantis, 66% of respondents either had a favorable view of him or said they simply had not heard enough about him. That means there's room for him to close this gap should he be the nominee. Let me tell you, as somebody living in Florida, don't. No. The more you know DeSantis, the more you know DeSantis. And the more you know, you don't want to know DeSantis. Got it. All right. There's other stuff going on. Late breaking news this afternoon. I told you about the Marquette thing. The House Select Committee investigating the events leading up to, during, and after January 6th announced today that they had issued more subpoenas, this time to those 14 individuals from seven states who filed those fake documents with the National Archives. Here's a report, because this just came down. I'm going to let NBC's Ali Vitale explain to you what happened rather than try to paraphrase it, because I'm already so scattered. I'm just waiting for the weekend. So I'll let Ali explain.
14 people subpoenaed today across seven different states, all of them states that Biden won, and all of them states where we saw fake slates of electors also sent to the National Archives. It really gives us a sense of how the January 6th committee is looking into the efforts to overturn the election results. The way that you can think about these fake slates of electors are that in these states that Biden won, in some of them, we were seeing the Trump campaign at the time try to contest the election results. Some of these slates of electors were being put forward in that vein, sort of following through to the end conclusion, even though Biden ultimately won those states. But what you can think of them as is bricks that are laid in the larger theory, or rather conspiracy theory, that some in the Trump orbit put forward at the time, which is that these fake slates of electors could be used by then Vice President Mike Pence on the day that he was certifying the election results on January 6th, and then supersede the will of the people and effectively make Trump stay president. Of course, we know that's not what Mike Pence did in the end, but you start to see the theory take shape here. It's also relative to people who we already know were subpoenaed. These 14 people, their names were on the fake slate of electors, but the committee really wants to know from them who was behind this strategy. We know that people in the then president's orbit, like Boris Epstein and his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, they were part of these conversations. Boris Epstein has said that he was part of this strategy and behind some of this thinking, but the committee is really trying to figure out where this originated from. They want to both hear from these electors and then also get documents from them. Those deadlines coming over the course of the next few weeks, but it's really giving us a sense of the way that this committee is drilling down on what the former president's orbit may have been trying to do around actually laying the groundwork to potentially overturn election results.
Interesting. So they are going out far and wide. Look, I'm glad it appears that they are being very comprehensive in sending out subpoenas and talking to people. Apparently, Mark Meadows showed up yesterday and was before the committee for over 6 hours, and he did not invoke the Fifth. So my question is, but did he lie? Because I don't put that past any of these people, because they know no shame. So could he have lied? Probably. But at least he spoke. He didn't take the Fifth, and he showed up. So I'm just waiting for those hearings to begin. And according to some of the members of this committee, the hearings will be epic. They liken them to, you know, bigger than Watergate. And this nation, you may not have been alive in the 70s, but this nation was transfixed. Watch those hearings nonstop. And that's what this should be. Should have been for the impeachment, but we live in opposite world. All right, we do have a guest coming up, and I told you yesterday that who we were going to talk to, and it's the guy who wrote this book. Well, his name is Bill Kopp, and the book is called Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records. I forget the subtitle, but it's about 415 Records and the rise of punk and new wave music. And really, this book focuses in on our friend Howie Klein, because Howie comes from that world. And in case, you know, you're new to the show and you don't know how I know, you know, Howie has been doing this segment with me, a weekly segment on this show for more than a decade now. It's got to be more than 10 years. He's moved with me from, you know, a different time of day to where we are now, live at 5 o'clock. And he's been doing this weekly thing with me for many, many years. Well, I knew Howie in a previous life. When we met, he was president of Reprise Records. Now, if you know, if you're not that into music, you may not realize what a big deal that is. Reprise Records is a division of Warner Brothers. That was Frank Sinatra's label. It's also the label that Eric Clapton was on, that Neil Young was on, that Green Day is on, that, you know, look at the roster of Reprise Records. That was Howie Klein. And so I met him when I was doing music radio in Los Angeles, and he was the president of this label. And the reason I knew him is because my station was very adventurous and creative. And, you know, we'd step out and play new music, and, you know, we weren't your typical, you know, pre-formatted radio station. So we struck up a friendship, a friendly acquaintance relationship. Anyway, so fast forward years later, he left Warner Brothers during when the Time Warner and AOL merged, because he saw the future, and they offered a buyout, early retirement, and he took the buyout and left. And he addresses it actually in an article I read recently, where he said, you know, it's time to turn things over to the next, you know, next generation. Let them have a say. I wish Nancy Pelosi would listen to him, you know, because she's running for re-election. She's running for re-election. Anyway, I start reading this book, and it's all about Howie. Like, check this out. Here's a picture from like the first page of the book. It is a very young Howard Klein. It is his senior class photo from Stony Brook University on Long Island from 1969. So, yeah. So, we're going to talk to the author of this book. The book is Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records and the Rise of New Wave. And again, it's like the Howie Klein story. So just a diversion, a bridge to the weekend that is not political, that will lower our collective blood pressure. But until our guest gets here, let me share with you just a few other stories that I've, you know, flagged, because it's sort of a free form Friday, anything goes. You know, the Florida legislature is in session now. It started last week and it runs until the beginning of March. It's really just a month long. Before the session began, there was a special election to fill a couple of state legislative openings. There was one congressional seat in Miami that had to be filled. Well, it's all over, actually. It was Alcee Hastings' seat before he died. And so there was a special runoff for that, to fill that seat. And it was filled by a wonderful progressive Democrat. I'm going to have to get her on the show one of these days. Sheila... And I'm going to screw up her last name, so I'm not even going to attempt it. But here's the story I want to tell you about. There's a guy. His name is Darrell Campbell. He was elected to the Florida House on January 11th. That is, what, 17 days ago already? But the Secretary of State, appointed by the governor, Mr. Death Sentence, will not send the letter certifying his election until at least March 8th. March 8th is 3 days before this legislative session ends. So there's this man, Darrell Campbell, who was elected to the Florida House almost 3 weeks ago, but this Secretary of State, I don't even know the person's name, Laurel Lee. Her name is Laurel Lee. She just will not send the letter certifying his election, because this is Florida. Because this is how they do things in this back-ass-words state of just fucking insanity.
Boy, all the desert.
Campbell went to Tallahassee to learn his way around and hoped to be sworn in next week when the full House meets. But Secretary of State Laurel Lee will not send a letter to the legislature declaring him the winner until March 8th. Why? Because March 8th would have been the date of a general election that ultimately was not needed, because only Democrats came forward to run for the seat. So when he won the primary, he won the seat. Of course, that's the reason. It's because he's a Democrat. And this state is run by the cons. Republicans. It's amazing. That the House Democratic leader is a guy named Evan Jenny. He He's apoplectic over this. He says the Secretary of State has one job in this instance, and that's certifying the election. If anything, they've stopped all the parts from moving. They've completely put us on some sort of list of do not respond. I can't get any answers. He said he walked over to the Secretary of State's office to get some answers, but waited for 4 hours. And then he said, no one has called or showed up. They're not responding to anyone. Neither myself as minority party leader, or more importantly, no one is responding to Representative-elect Campbell and his ability to represent 170,000 people in Broward County has been nullified. This is Florida. I'm so over it here. But my question to you is, where would I go? Where should I go? Where would you go? where could we possibly move to that, you know, I'm dealing with a weather wimp husband. So it's got to be a place that doesn't get too cold. And that's the rub. That's the problem. Because, you know, we're here in Florida. Now, granted, this weekend it's going to get down to 36 degrees. You wouldn't want to be in my house because it's not going to be fun here. So if we're to leave Florida, where could we go? So we're thinking, okay, Arizona. Arizona is almost as crazy as Florida these days. I guess a lot will depend on what happens in the next elections. But frankly, I'm feeling what? Don't shake your fist at me. You are a weather wimp. Where would you move? Where would you move? We don't want to stay here in Florida. So Arizona, as long as they don't, you know, overturn all the elections. I don't know. Do you want to answer or just want to shake your fist at me? He's mad because I called him a weather wimp. Okay. Yeah?
What I will say is that if Ali Batali married Martin O'Malley, she'd be Ali Batali O'Malley. And you mentioned Evan Jenny, and yeah. I have a problem with Evan Jenny.
Yeah, so do I.
He's the son of Ken Jenny.
Yes.
And Ken Jenny, when he was in the Florida legislature, put forth the first athlete agent bill in the United States. And as you know, there were issues with that law.
Oh, so that was all Ken Jenny. I'm not a big Evan Jenny fan either. This is my part of my problem with the Florida Democratic Party. It's the same old, same old, same old.
But wait, there's more.
Oh, of course.
Ken Jenny, this being Florida, yes. Having been the former Broward County Sheriff, went to the Gray Bar Hotel for fraud.
Yes, he did. That's right. I knew that. I did know that. Now, you know,
I am not a wimp.
Okay, you're a weather wimp. John Fowler in the chat room says, Arizona is horrible. Come to Vegas. John, did you not hear the interview I did the other day with the Nevada State Democratic Party chairman? And she is being ghosted by Jamie Harrison, the chair of the DNC. See what happened. And my guest, I'm going to get to you in just a moment, Bill. I'm sorry. Hold on just once. I got to just tell this. So in Nevada, they did a thing. If you've been listening to this program for any amount of time, you know that I participated in this at the behest of my dear late friend. God, I can tell it's Friday. I'm so out of it. He was the progressive activist here in Broward County. It's so apathetic here that people just don't get involved. But Mitchell Stolberg was involved, and he was a part of PDA and part of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida and everything. And he called me one day and he said, we're working on something. It's a group, a loose-knit group of Bernie supporters from the campaign around the country. And we are organizing quietly to do progressive takeovers of state Democratic parties. And I'm like, cool. What a great idea. So the idea was to get people to sign up and become precinct committee people and get a majority within each state's Democratic Party with the idea of a progressive running for the chair and all the leadership positions. Well, here in Florida, the land of the apathy, we weren't that successful. We got a few people in. We got a couple of new DNC members. But overall, we didn't do many county takeovers. It was not very successful here in Florida. And the Florida Democratic Party just really sucks, to put it in everyday terms. Well, I find out, though, that this group was really successful in Nevada. They won. They were successful in a progressive takeover of the Nevada State Democratic Party. And the woman who became chair, Nevada State Democratic Party chair, Judith Whitmore, she had been the Clark County chairperson. So that's Las Vegas, the biggest county in Nevada. So it's not like this was some outlier who didn't have any experience. But the Reid machine, that's the Harry Reid machine in Nevada, is very strong. And the establishment Democrats, part of the Reid machine, were not at all happy that these progressives engineered a progressive takeover of the Nevada Democratic Party. And they have frozen them out. They've basically done an end run around the Nevada State Democratic Party, duly elected by the members of the Nevada Democratic Party. And they're giving all the data access, the funding, and everything else to this state, to this county, county committee, working around the state Democratic Party. Jamie Harrison is freezing them out. So I interviewed Judith the other day, Judith Whitmore, and what she told me is astounding. This Democratic Party needs a complete changeover. Same way the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives needs new leadership. Nancy Pelosi's running again. Are you kidding me? She's held that seat since 1987. And it's time for new blood. And here's how I segue to our guest. So Howie Klein, who you know, he's on with me every Thursday, talked about in an article, I think that's up at downwithtyranny.com right now. We talked about it yesterday. It's about the music industry. And he talked about taking this buyout from Warner Brothers from when the Time Warner AOL merger happened. And he said, it's time for a changing of the guard. Bring in new young people. Let them run things. I'm not, you know, the be all and end all. It's not the Howie Klein record label. It's Warner Brothers. It's Reprise Records. It's time for a changing of the guards. And he said, part of me did it, hoping that others would follow me. A whole lot didn't. But, you know, that's Howie. And so that brings us to our guest. Bill Kopp is the author of a new book called Disturbing the Peace. The subtitle is what? 415 Records and the Rise of New Wave. Bill, welcome to the show, and thank you for writing this book. It's very cool.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. So, yes, I know Howie because he and I go way back, but not that far back. So I met Howie when I was doing music radio in Los Angeles, and actually at this one particular station that was very adventurous, and you know Howie's musical tastes are adventurous, and so he appreciated what we were doing, and we became friendly. So that years later, when we were both completely out of the music business, we reconnected, and now he's been my weekly guest for over 10 years talking politics. But we always wind up circling back to music because that's both of our first loves. But I got to ask, did you know Howie before you wrote this book? And what made you decide to tackle this subject?
The first question, did I know Howie? No, I didn't. Yeah. And what led to the project, the book essentially, around Thanksgiving of year before last, I wrote a short piece for SF Weekly about having to do with some reissues of some early 415 Records material. Mm-hmm. And just interviewing Howie for that and interviewing a couple of the other artists who are on the label in its early indie years, I knew immediately this is a much, much bigger story. And on a personal level, when I was in college, the records from the CBS 415 era, Wire Train and Translator, those were the soundtrack of my college years.
Oh, how interesting.
So I've always liked this music.
Right. And can I just tell you, there's an incestuous nature to this business because, okay, so I know Howie from when we were, you know, both in the music industry in Los Angeles. You're talking about, in San Francisco where he was before. Now, the foreword to the book is written by Joel Selvin. Joel Selvin is a journalist from the San Francisco area, who I never knew anything about because I was an East Coast person, and then I lived in Los Angeles until it's going to be convoluted here. So see if you can follow me. You mentioned Wire Train, and Wire Train was an early band that was on 415, and one wasn't one of the original members, but a later member went on later to work with Sheryl Crow.
And Brian McLeod.
Brian McLeod, right. And you write in the book that Wire Train, that Sheryl Crow might not have gone to where she went if not for Wire Train. Well, so, okay, I met Joel Selvin after Kevin Gilbert died. Kevin Gilbert was a dear, dear friend of mine. He was the front man for a band called Toy Matinee. Brilliant, brilliant singer-songwriter. He was, we sort of adopted him at a different radio station I worked at in LA called KLOS. And Toy Matinee, his road version of it, became kind of our house band. They were our friends. Wow. They'd play on our show. They played our Christmas show. They worked up a version of El Paso for a stupid birthday show we were going to do because one of the hosts, Mark of Mark and Brian, had a thing for Robin's El Paso. I forget his first name.
Marty.
Sorry?
Marty Robbins.
Marty Robbins. Thank you. Marty Robbins, El Paso. So Toy Matinee recorded a version of it. So we were very close. We were really good friends, right? So Sheryl Crow was Kevin Gilbert's girlfriend. She had been signed by A&M Records for some reason, I don't know why, and they rejected her first record. And so Kevin brought her to this Tuesday jam session he used to do every week with producer Bill Bottrell, who was also Wire Train's producer, and a group of musicians. They wound up writing and recording Tuesday Night Music Club, and gave that was Sheryl's record, but it was their record. And she totally like dissed them. And the story, there's plenty of stories around. But a year later, maybe 2 years later, Sheryl's riding high. Kevin went into, I don't know, some dark hole. He did, in the meantime, write and record a brilliant album called Thud. But there was a dark side of him that we didn't know about, and he died. And he died from autoerotic asphyxiation, of all things. And Joel Selvin wrote what I thought was the perfect story, but explained the whole relationship, what happened with Sheryl and Bill Bottrell and the whole story, and it was called Not Just the Piano Player. And I was so moved by that article that I reached out to him. I was going up to San Francisco for something else. And so we met for breakfast one morning to talk. So when I saw the book, it's like with a foreword by Joel Selvin. And then I see a whole thing about Sheryl Crow and Brian McLeod and Wire Train. I'm like, oh my God, this is very incestuous. So we have this connection, even though you didn't know. We kind of have this connection, but it's a small world. I mean, it's a big world, but it is a small world in that sense that there's a lot of cross-pollination here, right?
Oh, sure.
So when I first started working with Howie on doing politics and stuff, and, you know, we connect on this other weird music level. And one day he said to me, you know, there's a band, I don't know if you remember them, Translator, and I'm just like, everywhere that I'm not. You know, and so these are the songs that I got into college radio. I started in radio 79-80, which is around the time that this was going on. So I played Translator. I played Romeo Void. I played a lot of these artists that was, it was the beginning of New Wave. So some of this stuff came before me, and some of the artists you're talking about, I don't know because I was down here in Florida. And a lot of it is regional, but this is that era. So it takes me back to that mindset. Now, what were you doing during that time?
I have no idea. Don't remember. No, I'm kidding. I was in college. I was in college 81 to 86. And so I was buying records and playing in a cover band and listening to this kind of music. I went to Georgia State University, which is where WRAS, which was one of the most powerful, I think it was 100,000 watts for a college radio station. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty major force. And that's where I first heard a lot of this, and working in a record store too, you know.
Right, right. Well, you know, part of the thing you talk about the Ramones and how the Ramones were such a big influence on Howie and 415 Records and that whole genre of music. I'm going to thoroughly embarrass myself here because I was at WUSF for the radio station from the University of South Florida. How, another weird coincidence, right? Huh. And so I worked there throughout college. It was also a 100,000-watt station, but the idiots, the powerful people took over before I got there. There was a cool campus radio station called the Underground Railroad that was legendary. But by the time I got there, they had thrown all of them out and put on a classical format on the station. And student government got in, and they had jazz late at night. And then they got us 4 hours a week of music programming, Friday and Saturday nights from 11 to 1. For freeform radio that I eventually got to host. And then this other station started up, WMNF, that's still going strong in Tampa. But myself, my boyfriend at the time, and another woman went to the went to a hotel across the street from the Agora Ballroom in Tampa to interview the Ramones when they played there. So I will thoroughly, as I said, embarrass myself. I'm not going to play the whole thing. I do have, we produced a radio special. I'm going to play like 2 minutes of it for you because it's truly horrible. This is the very first artist interview I ever did. I must have been 21 years old, and I hadn't yet developed my voice. So the first voice you'll hear, believe it or not, is me. Okay, you ready for this? Here it goes.
On June 10th, 1980, the Agora Ballroom was filled to capacity with enthusiastic fans. The Ramones were making their first appearance in Tampa, Florida. I'm Nikki Sandler. Nikki.
I'm Pam Wiener.
And I'm Stu Septoff, and these are the Ramones. Although all of the original Ramones are from Forest Hills in Queens, they began practicing in a studio on 20th Street in Manhattan. They didn't own much equipment when they started out. Instead, they borrowed from other bands, saying, "We'll play with you guys if you let us use your stuff."
Each tried their hand at playing the few instruments they did have until they decided on the lineup familiar to Ramones fans. Joey sings, Johnny plays guitar, Dee Dee plays bass, and Tommy, the original drummer, has since been replaced by Marky. They all acquire the name Ramon upon joining the band.
All right, that's enough because it's really embarrassing. But that was me starting out in college in radio. And we sat in their hotel room with a tape recorder and interviewed them.
Cool.
It was very cool. I wish I had a picture. I don't. Right? I know. I got the recording, but no, never got a picture with them, which, you know, it is just a small world. And so now looking back on this, what do you do now, Bill Kopp?
I'm a full-time music journalist.
You are? Okay. And yeah. So you did the research and you write this book, Disturbing the Peace, which I didn't realize that's the police code for 415 is the Disturbing the Peace. I always thought it was 415 Records just because that's the area code of San Francisco.
It's both.
It is both. Yeah. And Howie said that too. So do you still listen to the music from 415 Records? Is that what you're, or are you just wide, you know, you've got a wide range of musical tastes?
Oh, I listen to all kinds of things. You know, it depends on my mood, but I still listen to all that stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I go back and you talk about some of the bands like The Nuns, which apparently I think was the first signing for Howie at 415. I didn't know The Nuns. I didn't know. And it may have been a regional thing, or it may have just been that it was before me or some music that I wasn't into. But the difference is there was a lot of music out then, but it's nowhere near what it is now. Again, the article that I mentioned that Howie wrote that's up at downwithtyranny.com that he told me is by far the most trafficked article he's ever written at downwithtyranny.com, which is interesting because it's a music industry piece. But it's about that, you know, it's drawing off this article in The Atlantic about how music, that older music is still dominating the newer stuff. And I'm wondering if it's because there's too much now. There's so many places from which you can get your music, so many different avenues where it used to be, you know, your radio station that you listened to, that's where you'd be introduced to new music. And now with the internet and everything else, there's a glut of it. And I don't think any band or artist today can break through the way they did back then. What do you think?
I think you're right. I mean, you look at what qualifies as a hit now may be something that most people have never heard. Somehow it's a hit. There was kind of a shared cultural understanding in the 70s. I mean, I knew all the funk and R&B hits of the 70s, even though I was a white suburban teenage right. kid who wasn't even necessarily into that kind of music, but you just knew it because it was sort of out there. And if something was a hit, you know, no matter who you were, where you lived, you knew what Led Zeppelin sounded like. You knew what the Silver Convention sounded like. Fly, Robin,
right.
fly.
Right.
And now everything is segmented into such small slices. It's narrow casting. You can live your whole life only listening to Christian death metal.
Does exist, right? There are Christian death metal bands, I guess. There's a genre for everyone. I was talking, again, I used to be so up on everything. I was a music director of a AAA station in Los Angeles. It was my business. I worked at, I don't know if you knew it then, KSCA, which was Gene Autry's last radio station, and he really let us do it. I mean, we did it right. It was great. And then, wow. you know, and then the Telecommunications Act kicked in and consolidation, and the station with a lousy signal was bought for something like $65 million, which at the time was unheard of. So we went off the air. Then, you know, I went down to San Diego, worked at 91X, came back up to LA and was part of a station that Clear Channel put on the air to try to replace it. And then consolidation again kicked in, and we were sold because we were two small signals. They again to another Spanish language company who turned it Spanish, and we became the first station to go seamlessly from over the air to internet only. This was in 2000. So we made history, and then the dot-com bust happened, and so we were ahead of our time. But so radio, it was going through all these different changes, just like the music industry, but it was a different world back then. With the advent of internet radio, or the internet period, I think everything became more and more fragmented. So there's not a whole lot of crossover. So like I watch Saturday Night Live, and half the time there are bands and artists I've never heard of. And usually they're bands and artists I don't want to hear of. I talked about my experience seeing DaBaby. Did you see Da Baby on Saturday Night Live by any chance?
No, I did not.
yeah, it was, you know, he's a rapper and rap is not my thing. I was, you know, not my thing. But I watched it and I couldn't turn away because of the dancers. He had upside down twerkers. So, you know, but then I saw a band called Bleachers, who I never heard of, and then I find out it's Jack Antonoff, and they were really good. So, okay, do you know of Bleachers?
I do not.
You see? And you're a music journalist. There's just so much of it out there that it's impossible. Now that I'm not in the music business, I don't hear a lot of new stuff. How do you stay up on it? How do you decide what music to listen to?
Part of it is that I connect with publicists who are promoting their artists, like-minded publicists, you know, right. not trying to stay in my own little lane, but publicists who, you know, they stay in touch with me to let me know about things that they think I would like, new things, because, you know, they're not going to send me the new Christian death metal album because, it's not really
not
my
thing.
But, you know, so that's one way. And my kids, I raised them right when they were teenagers. I bought them turntables and component stereos. And they're both they're like in their late 20s, early 30s now. And they turn me on to new stuff all the time. They'll say, oh, you probably like this newer act or new act. And so, you know, I take their advice because I didn't steer them wrong and they don't steer me wrong.
Right. You know, and back in the day where you're talking about in the late 70s, early 80s, you could find your radio station, even, you know, up to the late 90s, early 2000s, we still did great radio in Los Angeles and broke a lot of new artists. But those kind of radio stations barely exist anymore. The station like ours of that format that was in San Francisco is gone. That was KFOG, right? The few that were around, there's a handful still there. There's WXRT in Chicago. There's... most of the good ones left are non-commercials, WXPN out of Philadelphia. You know, there's a handful of them, but again, I could probably count them on a hand or two. The tastemakers, we used to look to our favorite DJ when they were able to pick the music to introduce us to the music that we would like. And that has been taken away now. And where it should have gone, like to the internet, it's not happening because of the music licensing travesty that's going on. When I play, you know, by mistake, 20 seconds of a Don Henley song that sneaks through, I get copyright violated and suspended from streaming on YouTube for 3 months. So here we are talking music. I've got Romeo Void queued up here, and I would love to hit it and compare Never Say Never with A Girl in Trouble is a Temporary Thing, which are two totally different songs, but still from the same band and both great. Right? But I can't, because chances are I'll get booted off of YouTube again. And again, and I would, if there were a way to do internet radio and pay reasonable fees for licensing and stuff, I would do it, but there isn't. Right. And it's really a shame, because this could be the most creative time in radio and a great way to get music out there and expose new music, except they put up so many roadblocks and make it impossible to do so.
That's true. Yeah.
So, I'd love to put on a really creative music channel. I'd like to do it with video because people like watching video, but even so, do it audio stream. But the licensing fees are so prohibitive. And if you get successful, the more people you have listening, the more expensive it is to stream. So you can never get ahead of it.
Right.
Do you think someday that'll be fixed? So maybe my kids sometime in the future will be able to do something like that, because it's a shame. We have this amazing technology and we can't use it.
It would be nice to think so. Who knows?
Who knows? All right. So what do you take out when you go back and, you know, you're researching for this book, 415 Records? It was a era. It was a specific time. You know, I go back and listen to the Ramones thing and it's like, oh my God, but I had to start somewhere. And the music was great. I was lucky enough to be able to go to CBGB's, and I don't think I saw the Ramones there, but I think I saw Talking Heads there. You know, I, again, I'm lucky to have lived that. What is your takeaway from that era? What's your takeaway from the book Disturbing the Peace?
I think it were a couple things. I mean, on one level, I think, 415, especially in its indie years, in the early years, captured the sort of the zeitgeist of the unique music scene that was happening in San Francisco. In that pre-internet era, these scenes in Chicago, in New York, in Athens, in San Francisco existed almost as separate little universes. If you were in one city, you might pick up a copy of New York Rocker and read about it, and you'd know a little bit about what was going on someplace else. But a lot of the times these scenes rose up more or less independently from one another. And so 415, not maybe by design exactly, but just by the way it worked out, sort of captures the vibe of a slice anyway of what was happening musically in that era. And then if you look at the larger story of Howie hooking 415 up with CBS Columbia, it's kind of an object lesson of what can go wrong. When, you know, I mean, you know, I understand his reasons for doing it, and you know, and I think it was the thing to do. It was the only way to move those artists into getting them the kind of tour support that they needed to go to the next level. But you know, it's a cliche to say it's making a deal with the devil, but to some extent, that's kind of what it was.
And right. so and I think he saw history repeating when AOL came into Warner Brothers and he said, I'm not doing that again.
Exactly. Exactly. But there's a lot of great music left behind. 28, 29 groups, and it was an era of groups, were on 415 at one time or another. And if you can find that music, it's really, really good stuff.
Yeah. Again, I'd play a few things if I could, but I worry. It depends who owns the publishing. Universal Music Publishing Group seems to be the worst. But we're now at a time when Bruce Springsteen sold his back catalog for $500 billion. Bob Dylan just sold his. We're hearing over all these artists are selling their catalogs, which is all well and good. It's going to make these copyright violations endemic. It's going to be every time you know, I once posted a video of my dog swimming in the pool. And music was playing in the background, and I got hit because of that. Now, I challenged it, and they finally relented. But that's the kind of stuff. The copyright police are out. It's the antithesis of what music should be. Music is creative, and it should, you know, I know there are some artists, Don Henley, who don't want their music on the internet. Michelle Schacht, another one. You know what? Then don't put it out there. Sorry, in this day and age, find another way to monetize. I mean, it sucks. They need to get paid for their art, but to say you can't play it on the radio or on the internet radio is really a shame. This is a really tough time for someone like me who wants to be able to play music and share it and turn people onto it, and I can't for fear that I'm going to get, you know, hit for it.
Sure. Yeah.
So, okay, Bill Cobb, so that's your assignment, is to write a story on the ills of the money people in the music industry who are keeping great music from getting played and shared freely, and so that's why we don't know who Bleacher is. Just saying. Anyway, the book is Disturbing the Peace. It is out now. I know it's available through Amazon and other outlets. You may have to look for it. I don't like shopping from Amazon, but, you know, there's a bookshop.org. Do you know if it's available through bookshop.org?
I don't know. I know it's available through IndieBound, which is a consortium of independent bookstores.
Good.
And it's available directly from the publisher.
Ah, okay, good. So did you send me that information? If you send me that information, I'll put it out on the blog with,
fantastic.
You know, rather than send people to Amazon. Bill Kopp, it was so nice to meet you. I'm sorry. I feel like I dominated this whole conversation, but
you
get me started talking about music and something takes over. So
I understand. I'm the same way.
I hear you. So I'm actually sitting here, you know, I've got, We're off. We're in overtime now. This show goes live on the Progressive Voices Network and a few other places. And of course, I stream to YouTube and other places. But sometimes I go into overtime. So we're off the network and I get to loosen up a little bit. And I, you know, from those days when I was doing good radio, I have a number of interviews with performances. And I try to figure out which ones won't get me in trouble, like which ones I can play. And I won't get, you know, hit hard. And I'm thinking, I have a Graham Parker interview. Now,
he's a great interview.
Oh, he's so, I was a huge Graham Parker fan back in like the 70s and 80s when he did Squeezing Out Sparks and, right? I mean, going way back, Discovering Japan and Heat Treatment and all that stuff. And I had the opportunity to interview him at KSCA in Los Angeles. And I was thinking that might be a good way to end the show. And I don't know if I'm going to get hit for it, but I don't think I am because I don't think he was on a major label then.
He was on Arista. He was on Mercury.
Right. He was on Mercury because he did Mercury Poisoning, which was one of the best songs ever about a fucked up record label and that worked on two levels. But this was the later years. It was Acid Bubblegum was the album he was promoting then. And I think that was on an indie label.
That's on an indie, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
But I wonder who has his publishing, because it seems to be the publishing that gets... You know, the other thing they do is they do what's called content IDs. And I'll get an email that says, copyright issue, and my stomach will drop. And then it'll say, this is not a strike. So what they do is they identify, they have bots crawling I guess, YouTube all the time, and they identify a piece of music, and they say, that's a match. Now, we're not going to give you a copyright strike. We're not going to tell you to take it down, but any money you make off of advertising on that episode, we're gonna take.
Garnish. Wow.
They're going to garnish. Right. So that's, so I do, so I can live with that. It's not like I make a lot of money from YouTube. It's pennies. And if they want to take my paltry pennies, go for it.
Come get them.
Yeah. Right. So that, you know, I had last week, do you remember John Hall? From Orleans. Right? Yeah. Who went on to be a congressman. He was part of No Nukes. Well, he's got a new album out. And I had him on. One of the songs is about saving the monarch butterfly. It was really great. And I want, you know, so I played that song and I played Power from No Nukes. Right?
Oh.
And he went through a whole thing. I went with his people to give me clearance to play the butterfly song. And I thought, okay, well, I'm worried about Power because I think I'm going to get hit, but we'll see what happens. When I got the copyright notice, it was a content ID for the Monarch song. Even though it's his thing, it just automatically happens. And Power, nothing. Nothing. It wasn't even picked up by the bots. So I never know what I'm up against.
You never know. Yeah, it's frustrating to have to go through all that.
It really is. It really is. So I will leave it up to the chat room if you guys want to hear the Graham Parker. I'd listen to Graham Parker all day, any day, but it's, I'll leave it up to them too. If they want to hear it. If you want to hear it, you're welcome to hang on the line, and I'll leave, instead of the news on this Friday, I will go out with an interview with Graham Parker. All right?
Cool.
Okay. All right. Well, Bill Kopp, it was very nice to meet you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for writing this book. Love reading about Howie and being able to, you know, hold a few things over him from the old days. all right. Take care, Bill. Thanks again.
Thanks. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. And I'll tell you what, everybody else, I will. I'll leave you. I'll play this Graham Parker interview just because I can. And yes, he does perform a few songs. So from 1996, actually the date was November 6th, 1996. It's Graham Parker.
FM 101.9, LA's finest rock. We have moved into the music hall, and it's been 20 years since the release of his debut album. Graham Parker has just released a brand new one called Acid Bubblegum. He's on tour again and with us today in the music hall. Welcome back.
Hello there.
Hello there.
Thank you waving, for coming but nobody in. Can see it.
So. No, it's radio. You got to have the words to go along with the gestures. You're at the House of Blues tonight, tomorrow night at the Coach House.
Yeah.
Now, the last few times you've been through town, because I've seen, I think, every tour, you've been solo.
Actually, no. The last tour I wasn't solo. I played the House of Blues with the Episodes, as I dubbed them, which is a four-piece band promoting 1,200 episodes.
Right. Okay.
Before that, it would have been solo, probably somewhere. I'm not sure.
A few different places.
Yeah.
So is this the same band you have with you this time?
Oh, the record company are really informing you on everything, aren't they? No, I'm touring with The Figs. It's Graham Parker and The Figs, who are a band of guys who are like slightly younger than me, should we say, and on Capitol Records. They're on a major label and I'm on a minor label. And they're my backing band for this tour and opening act as well.
Oh, great.
So it's, you know, anybody who's completely fed up with my acoustic shtick, you know, that I've been doing over the last few years, even, as I say, the last band was, there was no lead guitarist, it was just me, it was a lot of acoustic, the open tuning stuff. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's fed up with that should come to see this show because this is like, you know, kicks butt, as they say in California. I mean, it rocks, you know, these guys really, it's a rock and roll show, it's nothing to do with the folk singer that you know and love. You know, it's...
As in Graham Parker,
yeah,
folk singer?
That's right, me, you know, that mellow guy.
Right.
It's, it really, you know, it really kicks. These guys are fantastic. And it's, that's a whole different tour for me because of that, you know, that getting a band that are self-contained as opposed to disparate people stuck together, you know.
Right.
You know, they got their energy, you know, they jump and things.
Cool. Well, it's tonight, House of Blues. You're sitting here, though, solo with that acoustic folk guitar in hand.
Yeah. I couldn't fit the figs in the studio.
Well, that's fine. We like to have you here.
Besides,
like
they're probably still in a truck somewhere getting here, whereas I flew.
Oh, okay. That's the... That's the advantage of having your name out in front.
That's right. Yeah, you fly and they hitchhike.
Right. You know? All right. Well, you've got the guitar in hand. What are you going to do for us first?
I don't know. Let's see. Sharpening axes from Acid Bubblegum. I'll give that a go. I'm not selling molasses. I'm not pushing tea. I don't appeal to the masses, and they don't appeal to me. I'm not peddling fiction. Tools. I can't access information coming down on the mainframe. Those puerile incantations in couplets are quatrains. Yeah. Hey, hey, hey.
In the FM 101.9 Music Hall, the song Sharpening Axes found on the brand new album Acid Bubblegum. I love this record. Really, really good record.
Thanks a lot.
Acid Bubblegum, it does include that legendary Graham Parker acerbic wit.
Well, yeah, you know, the last record I had out, 1,200 episodes, was pretty much irony-free, actually, like America, you know. And, you know, it's kind of pastoral and bucolic. Not like, unlike America.
Right.
Uh-huh. And so, you know, I like to, like, you know, after 6 months the record's been, a record's been out, it's like, why did I do that? You know, it's kind of like cringe, you know.
Just, I like that record. This one, so do I adore.
But just the memory of it, you know, it's kind of cringeworthy. But I was very pleased with 1200 episodes because it was a very new direction rhythmically on a lot of songs for me, you know. And it was all this open G tuning thing. So I did something different. But this, I thought I'd do the same old junk, you know.
Well, this reminds me of early Graham Parker,
right? Yeah,
but I would not call it junk. In fact, in your own description of the album, you wrote a very humorous piece, which is what we've come to expect from you. You use the word hostility a lot. But, you seem to have mellowed over the years.
I'm a hostile kind of... Well, not if you listen to this record. No, I sound like a raving lunatic.
But there's humor.
Like a train wreck.
Well,
yeah, there is humor, yeah. I think, you know, I was just thinking the other day about really early stuff like Don't Ask Me Questions and Howling Wind. It was very sort of apocalyptic, you know. There wasn't a lot of humor involved in that,
right.
I must say. But over the years, it's more of a game for me to try and say something and do it in a funny way that not everybody gets. But I think the first line of Sharpening Axes, I don't appeal to the masses and they don't appeal to me. Mm-hmm. I think that's hilarious, you know. Maybe that's just my sense of humor, but, you know, I try to put in stuff in songs that I think is humorous.
Right. There's also a song called Obsessed with Aretha that I really like, and although it's kind of politically incorrect, I probably wouldn't play it on the air, but I do enjoy it in my car.
Oh, yeah. Can I play it live, or is that incorrect?
I think you can do whatever you want.
I'm sure I can, yeah, if you want me to.
Whatever you like, we can do next. But I do want to ask you about, there is something of a Graham Parker resurgence going on. Squeezing Out Sparks is coming out in a remastered CD. There are a bunch of live releases coming out, of course, the new album. But there's a Graham Parker tribute album that's out called Piss and Vinegar, The Songs of Graham Parker.
Is it out?
I think it's out. I haven't seen it yet. I keep hearing about it.
Yeah.
I love the title. Who came up with that?
I think the record company. They were going to call it something else, though, because they thought, nah. This is a record company from Hackettstown, New Jersey, called BioDie Records. And one of the guys there said, this other Jersey band called them, so the record Piss and Vinegar. And I said, well, that's, you know, I've never heard of it. Nobody has, so... Mm-hmm. Carry on. This is a great title. Don't change it. They were going to call it from Howling to Haunted or something like that. But anyway.
This is better.
Yeah. Yeah, it works.
Were you involved in it in any way other than that?
I did a gig in Hackettstown, New Jersey for these guys, you know, these Jersey dudes, you know. They're pretty pretty interesting bunch. And it was good in this place, a sort of college hall or something. It was packed out. It was great. So, and they got a local radio station in the college, and I plugged the record. That was months before it came out. But they sent me tapes, you know, or actually a fan got hold of a broadcast from this station, taped it, and gave me a tape, you know, of some of these songs broadcast on the radio by various artists. And, you know, it's sort of your mouth kind of drops open after listening to three songs in a row, you know, my own songs
right.
that somebody's took the time and the trouble to actually do, you know. I mean, they didn't take the time and trouble to learn the words properly, but, you know, what do you expect? And they made mincemeat of some of my profound... You know, couplets and quatrains, they made mincemeat of them. It's like, what do they think I mean? This is unbelievable. You know, it's incredible.
Well, they're too young to know better, right?
Whatever, yeah. That, you know, you get a few words wrong and it's crucial to a song that's 3 minutes. You know, it's
right.
like there's only like, you know, a few dozen words in a song. You get something wrong and it's like, no, I didn't mean that at all. What are they doing? But, you know, obviously it's just flattering that somebody's taken the trouble to do this and put it together. It's about 20 different songs, you know.
Well, you have enough to draw from, that's for sure. Enough great songs. All right, you want to do another new one for us? And then I'll impose on you to do an old favorite.
Okay, yeah. Let's do Obsessed with Aretha.
Okay.
Girl singers obsessed with Aretha. You get a lot of little swingers wishing they could be her. Some of those sisters can rock and roll. All God's children got a little bit of soul, but not that much. Oh no, no, not that much. You get a lot of fat Christians want to throw to the lions. Put them in a barrel and roll them off the top of Mount Zion. fame, but not that much. Oh, no, no, not that much, yeah. Now when you hear Aretha singing on some advertisements, or with a big fuzzy band, or some rock and roll museum concerts, well, she still got the lungs and the dress and the stole. You might even say the girl still got soul, but not that much. Oh, no, no, not that much. You get a lot of little monkeys swinging from the treetops. You get a lot of little flunkies singing on top of the pops. Some of them appear in the gutter press, telling you their lives are in a mess, but not that much. Oh, no, no, not that much. You get a lot of little swingers pulling out their pen knives, cutting up history and juggling with lies. Being a reporter is a glamorous trade. You don't even have to tell the truth to get paid, but well, not that much. Oh, no, no, not that much. Now when you hear Aretha singing on some advertisements, or with a big fussy band, or some rock and roll hall of fame concerts, she still got the lungs and the dress and the pink stole. You might even say the girl still got soul, but not that much. No, 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 not that much, yeah. Hey, hey, much. No, 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 not that much. Chain, 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 chain of fools.
Oh, yeah. Graham Parker with us in the FM 101.9 Music Hall, obsessed with Aretha, another song from the new album Acid Bubblegum. Going to be at the House of Blues tonight, Coach House tomorrow night, and I would think that as you tend to do, you'll do some new music and some old favorites?
Yeah, from Howling Wind, Heat Treatment, Stick to Me, Steady Nerves even, we do something from Fastest Song Ever Known to Man, as played by the Figs, and, you know, Acid Bubblegum stuff, of course.
Great. Can I get you to reach back and do one of those oldie?
Yeah, okay. Please? Yeah, sure. This one's from Heat Treatment, as a matter of fact. Waited all night, jumped all the red lights, dodged all the turnpikes, took all the wrong rights. I pulled up outside, made the cat run down the street. The washing line is hung with sheets. The night is dark and sweet, oh. Shut it out. Hey, when you touch me, baby, my treble sounds a little lighter. My bass booms a lot brighter. My rhythm rocks a little tighter. Oh, I may be wrong to keep back your love this way. The only reason I'm hanging on to keep the front door folks away. Back to love, back to love, and no
just a backdoor love. It's just a backdoor love. Backdoor love, and let nobody shut it. Backdoor love, and let nobody shut it. Backdoor love, and let nobody shut it out. Ooh, yeah, don't shut it out. Don't shut it out.
Graham Parker in the FM 101.9 Music Hall. As a fan, thank you for all the years and all the great music you've put out, and please keep it coming. We'll see you tonight at the House of Blues, tomorrow night at the Coach House, and the new album called Acid Bubblegum. Graham Parker, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
UPN is about to go...